about this thing that's in my brain. It keeps me from wanting to go on, but I want some game.
All right, you ready to go?
Maybe a little fame.
All right, let's go in 3, 2, 1. Everybody, welcome back to the We the Patriots podcast. I'm your host, Sal Asante, and today I have with me another author, and today I have Lance Hilsinger. Lance, it is wonderful having you. It's just reading into some of the themes and some of the arguments in your book. This is the type of conversations we love having on this show, and we think that are very helpful to just get into the public eye and get people thinking. So without any further ado, tell us about not only one, but two books you've written so far.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me.
Of course.
And that's one of the reasons why I wrote books, is I want to encourage a good national civil debate about the challenges that America faces. I was a child welfare social worker with the juvenile court for 34 years. And so my first book is In Place of the Parent, Inside Child Protective Services. Child Protective Services is probably poorly understood by lots of people. They think social workers either overreact or underreact. And so explains the system and how the system has improved over my career that I had, but how there's also a lot of ways that it still falls short. Most of the children that are placed into foster care, and I had, except for 1 year, I dealt with court cases of one type or another. So a lot of child welfare cases never become court cases. The vast majority never become, but I only had court cases except for the first year of my career. Almost all of those come from parents who are poor enough in California to afford court-appointed attorneys. In some states, parents don't get court-appointed attorneys. They have to represent themselves. And because I saw how much poverty there was, I felt like, well, we need to look at poverty in America. Why is that happening? And frankly, many of the men in my caseload were, to use a very unprofessional term, losers.
Okay.
I can't find a professional term that conveys that phrase just as well. They were losers.
Sure.
Very often, they were not necessarily abusive. Some were. Some were abusive to kids. Some were abusive to the mother and the family.
Mm.
But really, the majority of them were, one definition or another, losers. They were in jail. Or if they weren't in jail, they were barely managing to make ends meet. There were exceptions, of course. But I'm talking to a good number of them, certainly the majority, we're just not being very successful in life. And if you're not successful in life, you're probably not very successful as a parent, even if you've not been directly endangering a child. Because very often we have a situation where there's the mother and the boyfriend with the kids, or the mother alone with the kids. The kids are removed from the mother's home because of drugs, of neglect or something. And we have the absent father. The absent father may be very involved with the kids. More times than not, in one case I had it, he was not. And so why do we have all these men who are not very successful in life?
Right. And how do you treat that situation from a CPS standpoint? Or what was your guys' tactic in handling a situation where the father not necessarily wasn't present, but was just an absolutely poor influence?
Well, it depends. It assess the situation, hopefully get him going in life. Sometimes they were out of the area. That was always a struggle. If you have the absent parent, I was in San Luis Obispo County. For your listeners, that is about 90 miles north of Santa Barbara. We're just about halfway between Los Angeles and San Francisco. So sometimes the absent father might be in another county or might be the other side of the county, and just hard to get that person involved. If they were local, then we got into programs. And if he had a criminal background, we on probation or something, you try to get him to, you know, become a law-abiding citizen, become a full, to deal with whatever problems kept him from being an involved parent. And very, very rarely, though, did he ever assume custody. If you had the father who was out of the home, he was keeping involved with the kids, and all the events happened to mom's home, then the father would get custody relatively soon. That didn't happen very often, but it did happen. So there were involved, concerned, supportive fathers out there. but they're relatively few and far between.
And so without that supportive father in mind, what kind of tendencies did you start to recognize as you're especially thinking about writing a book, I'm sure? What did you recognize with these loser men, or these absolutely, without any better term, just men who do not strive to be better?
Well, I took it in the whole context of the poverty program, so the war on poverty. I'm old enough to remember when Johnson was promulgating that. That was like when I was a child. I was, in the 60s. I was born in 1958. But all of that, okay, we're gonna have a better America. We're gonna have this war on poverty. We're not gonna have these things. And how have those programs served that purpose of trying to get both moms and dads successful? One of the things, one of the quirks in welfare, is that if there's the absent dad, and if he's got a stable job, let's say the mom has two kids, and she has one kid from one dad who's a loser or a semi-loser, and the other guy's got a stable job, okay, and he's got to make pretty good money. For the child, for the guy who's making pretty good money, she'll get child support. That'll be more than her welfare. But for the guy who's not making so much money, kind of in the fringes of economic society, and she's getting welfare, any work that he does, anything that he earns, all but the first $50 goes to the government. And she gets $50 for the bureaucratic expression is cooperating with paternity issues. Now, that sounds, to conservatives, I think that sounds great. Okay, you're making the dad pay back what the taxpayer's paying for this kid. You know, it's his responsibility, and now taxpayers' money. But what happens in practice is that drives the father, because he's kind of in a marginal situation to begin with, he's more likely to pick up criminal activity. He's more likely to work cash jobs. I had a lot of dads in my case that work cash jobs.
Makes a lot of sense. So you're hiding
irregularly because you're kind of trying to avoid that child support. And it also makes a very bad relationship between him and his kids. You know, if whatever he earned and this, the child support that he could pay went to the kids and supplemented her welfare, she's going to see the dad in a better light. The kids are going to see him in a better light. He's going to have something more to live for. You know, he's going to be more positive about himself because he says, okay, I picked up this work.
Just being held responsible.
Yeah, I picked up this work and it's going to my kids. Yeah, they're taking X number of dollars out of my check, but I know it's going to my kids. He's much more encouraged to be part of mainstream society. If you say, hey, we're going to take X dollars out of your check and it's going to go to Uncle Sam, he says, I don't care so much about Uncle Sam. I have rent to pay. I have my expenses. I'm going to try to kind of dodge the system. And that's human nature.
Right.
I think one of the things that one of the maximums in social work is we take people as they are, you know, not how we wish them would be. We'd wish everybody would have a good work ethic. We'd wish everybody would not abuse drugs or alcohol, you know, but that's not how they are. We're flawed people. Mm-hmm. And
absolutely.
So that's what I wanted to look at, is that what are we going to do to help these guys be more successful?
Absolutely. Did you write that first book in or out of retirement?
I finished it up in retirement. I wrote most of it on my own time, collected things, but I polished it just after I retired.
Gotcha. Okay. So, and I'm sure it leads right into where you wanted to write a second book, more focusing on what I'm sure you're about to talk about.
Yeah. And that the, you know, we have all these programs and that are supposed to alleviate poverty. And a lot of people say, oh, government waste and whatever. You and I can't say that there isn't any waste. Obviously, there's going to be waste, some. Mm-hmm. But one of my points is that it's demographics. Is that a woman who has a high school education, or just that's all she has, she's likely to have more children than a woman who has a college degree, much more likely. You know, the women with college degrees have actually a negative birth rate. They have less than about 1.7 children. Yep. So they have a negative birth rate, but presumably with a college degree, she's able to support herself. Woman with a high school diploma or less, is more likely to have more children, mm-hmm. and therefore more likely to also more likely to need public assistance of one form or another. But one of the points I make out is the man who, she becomes a drag, an economic drag in cold business terms. She's an economic drag on taxpayers. Mm. The man who doesn't complete high school, he's more likely to father a child he can't afford to support. And he's more likely to drift into criminal activity. His failure to graduate high school is a matter of public safety. He's not just an economic drag on society.
Correct.
He is, it's a matter of public safety. So if we are going to be serious about making things better, we need to address the graduation, the dropout rate, particularly boys of color or African-American, Hispanic. They have a much higher dropout rate than girls of comparable race, ethnicity. A white girl has a much greater possibly graduating high school than an African-American boy.
Just based on statistics now, right?
Based on statistics. And it's, go ahead.
So one of the questions that I had was, did you do any research or did your research point in any direction when you were looking at it through a lens of religion, or did you pay attention to that?
Well, you get into, one of my quirks in my first book that I pointed out was that you're supposed to assess, there's this new thing about assessing children, and if they are participating, if the family participates in religious activities, that's positive right. for family. You have a corresponding score on this assessment scale. Well, so what? If you're a civil servant, what can you do with that information? You can't tell people from a civil servant to go to church, even though we know that people who go to have faith are more likely to be law-abiding and more likely to pay their taxes and be as mainstream as such. Of course, there's exceptions.
Right, but not only that, don't you also come at it with religion? This is coming off of what you stated earlier, though, but aren't you also going to see a trend of religious following families having more children as well?
I didn't look at the statistics. It's not broken down by that because the Census Bureau okay. by law is not allowed to ask a religion.
Got it. Okay. So you can only look at it as an event.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes more sense. Got it.
I was a census worker, by the way, both in college and in retirement. So this, a lot of what I talk about comes from Census Bureau figures, and just most of the figures I'll cite are from 2020. That's pre-pandemic, right. mostly pre-pandemic. And so we want to have that as a baseline because
Absolutely.
The pandemic makes things really weird.
Yeah. Pandemic was a very strange time, and you do see, I believe it just continued the downward trend of losing religion, but did it continue a trend of dropouts increasing?
I think there's a general statistics that the test scores dropped. I think that's pretty much
right.
clear. But they
right.
dropped.
Absolutely. That's
whether it's the dropout rate, yeah. I think so, but I wouldn't want to, I don't have a statistic off
okay.
the top of my head. But definitely okay. the test scores have dropped because of the remote learning.
Yeah.
And the schools did, by and large, a good part. My daughter's a teacher, and the schools did a good part of getting Chromebooks to kids and things like that, lessons planned. But of course, if you have a computer, you also have to have the internet if you're going to have remote
Always.
Learning. And then how does a poor person who can barely make rent, how can they pay for the internet service and that kind of thing? That's a struggle
right.
there.
Right. And you're automatically creating a difference in what economically they can afford is going to also tend on their kids as well. It's pretty sad.
Right.
So what did you start to find in your second book here? It looks like you researched a lot into the gender differences. What was your main findings, and was there something that really disturbed you in doing all this research?
Well, it sort of validated what I kind of understood to be intuitively correct, or the thought was correct. And then I looked and yeah, sure. It was even worse in some ways. For instance,
isn't that a saying? Once you start peeling back that onion, you just get layers and layers and layers.
Yeah. For professions to go in the other way. We're talking about high school graduations, but if you look at professions, medicine, law, psychology, not dentistry for one reason, but veterinary, the majority are women.
Right.
Now for veterinary, it's almost 3-1 now. Of all the professional schools, dental was the only school that was about 50-50. I don't know why that was it, but for optometrists. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, mental health needs. Men have a suicide rate much higher than women. The suicide is the third most common type of death for men 30 to 39, but it's ninth for women. And if you get to older men, senior men, it's much more difficult for every older woman, like over 65 that commits suicide, there's like 7 or 8 men. So men have these unmet mental health needs because they're committing suicide at a much higher rate. It's not because they're veterans. This is not, there's that small factor of that there, but that, if you look at the ages and things like that, it's only a small percentage. So you can't be contributed to combat experience or something. And yet the number of psychologists since 2013, it's been more women than men, and that the spread has been increasing. Men are probably going to relate better to a male therapist, a woman to a female therapist generally. And so that's one of the things that we need to address in our society.
You see one of the big problems being that we don't have a lot of male teachers as well?
That's true. The proportion of male teachers has been decreasing. It's never been, when I went to high school, it was about 50-50. Mm. And it's now about 60-40.
That's 60. Generous.
Yeah, it's generous.
That's generous. Yeah, I think it's generous. Yeah. Having gone through high school recently, that's generous.
Yeah. More recently, yeah. Well, that's your school. Of course, it varies. I didn't want to overstate things. But yes. And studies show that boys will be better behaved in class if there's a male teacher. So that's goes in with the, and there's one study, particularly with African-American boys, that if they had an African-American male teacher in their school, in elementary school, not necessarily their own teacher, but at least at the school, their graduation rate was 15% higher or some significant percentage higher. That the effect was that powerful.
That's
so
amazing.
Why are we doing to encourage more men to become teachers? I haven't heard anything. I don't hear any, you know, public service announcements or, you know, any kind of promotions there.
I feel like it's really been taken out of a lot of the mainstream media and a lot of just our whole culture. It seems to subvert men to empower women.
Sorry,
or to put them
up there for a second.
Nope. Can you hear me?
Yeah. You just locked up there for it. Yes. Yes. There's a lot about that. And even female therapists that I dealt with, some of them recognized it. Some of them recognized that there was like this all girl power stuff, and then the boy clients, they didn't have the same there. So I think there's some recognition to that. That's just incidental things. And one of the things that makes things kind of transition is that if you, like in my generation growing up, typically the man worked and the woman stayed at home. That was, and that was affordable. You know, you could afford a house on one salary. Nowadays, it takes 2 salaries to afford a home. And even then, you may not be able to afford a home.
Right.
And the home ownership is one of those things that is important to carry on wealth. When you die, my children will inherit equity. And that's what I inherited from my parents that helped me out. And this is one of these things, how important home ownership is. And the declining rate of home ownership corresponds with a declining rate of poverty. You know, that's an effect we have. And we need to figure out ways so that people can own their own homes. You know, we have this Habitat for Humanity program, but that just is a small portion. And that may not be the most efficient way to get people to be homeowners. You know, right. We have government programs, the FHA programs, things like that for first-time homebuyers, but that's not enough anymore.
Right. And I think one of the biggest challenges that we're facing now as a country is that the prices have risen to a point where it doesn't matter how much assistance you're giving, the price is so steep. So your income has to be so high. One of the people that I really like to listen to is Dave Ramsey. And I think one of his ways of talking about it with money is you need a big shovel in order to fill the hole. And if you keep making the hole bigger, but you never increase the size of the shovel, you can't fill the hole. So we're as a country just making this hole bigger and bigger and bigger with no solution on the shovel side.
I think that's absolutely right. In San Francisco, the qualifications, the income qualifications for subsidized housing is over $100,000.
Right.
You know, because it costs so much. And in San Luis Obispo, where I am, it's not quite as expensive as San Francisco. It's still a very expensive place to live, but the wages aren't not nearly as good. So, you know, that's you have to always take that as a percentage. What is the common wage and what is the percentage of rent? And part of it is supply and demand. It's a very simple thing. We have more people in the United States, and we have more poor people than there were in like the 1970s. There's more.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. When you just build the population up, you're not going to be just building up the rich and the middle class. The poor class, which is the most of any class, is building at the highest rate.
You know, if you want to think of one of the chapters of my book kind of talks a little about the wealth pyramid. And the rich, the average ratio of a CEO, top CEO, Fortune 500 CEO to the average worker salary, that ratio has been climbing and climbing and climbing. It's, you know, it's 100 to 1, it's 200 to 1.
Right.
Depending on where you look, but everyone agrees it's climbing, exactly how much there's difference in statistics. So the wealth are, the rich are getting richer, but yes, the base of the pyramid is getting wider. And
right.
So both of those things are true. Both of those things
are true. Yeah, and there's an incentive to keep that high paid earner. There's an incentive to keep him high paid and pay him higher than the next guy. So as that next CEO gets the bigger check, the CEO around the corner wants the raise to get up.
Right.
And that's
right.
All driven by stock prices. That's all driven by shareholder meetings. And that stuff can't end, or else our whole economy isn't functioning properly.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, we do have to address that. We carry a very heavy welfare load, an increasingly welfare load. One of the statistics I have in my book, and that I find it, like I said, most of my statistics come from the Bureau of Labor Statistics or the Census Bureau or some other government sources. I wasn't going to try to pick and choose from, you know, myopinion.com. Most of my references are from, you know, government sources. But WIC, I don't know if you're familiar with that program. It stands for Women's Infants Children. It's to give supplemental milk and nutrition to poor women, you know, for the child, for the young child. 60% of babies now born in the United States qualify for WIC.
Really? 60%?
Yeah. 60%. Nearly 60%.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nationwide. That's unbelievable.
Yeah. And that sad statistic's going to carry on. You know, that's...
my goodness.
So, what do you do constitutionally to discourage that? You know, to get people to put off having children until they're financially are not going to be dependent upon government.
And one of the things that I'm worried about, and I'm a younger person trying to get into home ownership status, is like, does this rabbit keep running away from me? As I'm getting closer and closer, it keeps getting faster and faster.
Right. Just hypothetically, say you're trying to save $500 a month, but the house that you want to buy goes up $6,000 a month. You're right. You'll never catch it. It's not proposed in the book, but one thing that I think that I've since been doing these podcasts is that non-owner-occupied homes, there should be a penalty. In San Luis Obispo, traditionally it was a, you know, single-family home ownership, you know, but the home ownership rate has decreased, and almost people moving in are renters because they can't afford
to buy. I was going
to
say, but you know, the problem with that is you install that penalty, and the penalty is going to get passed down to the renter, so rent's going to go up.
No. If you're buying a house, if you're, say, a corporate buyer, non-occupied purchaser, then that person, then that would make the price more cheaper for the homeowner, the person who's owner-occupied housing.
Yes, correct. But those people are going to be more willing to pay that higher price, and then the rent is going to go up regardless. It's not going to be...
we're talking about homes for being sold.
Yeah. When one of those big corporations buys a rental property, whatever price they pay is just going to eventually get passed on a higher rent scale. I think that's what the problem is.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So what I'm thinking is that if you discourage it enough, you're going to let the homeowner buy the owner-occupied housing. Yes.
Yeah, that's where you need it. You need that to be incentivized enough where the homeowner gets a break, basically. It can't be...
Right.
Yeah, I don't think it could be a tax on the higher people, even though they'll see it that way anyway.
Right. So, yeah, because... Yeah. One of the things, although I also point out, is that, you know, California's population is about doubled since in my lifetime. What has not doubled is California's size.
Right.
You know?
Or the amount of livable area. Yeah,
the amount of livable area. And you how much livable area to trade off area that can be farmed or area that you...
Correct.
Do, you know, and so we're reaching a limit here. Do we want to look like, you know, New York or Hong Kong with buildings going, you know, 80 stories? That's not a way for kids to live, families.
No,
to
but it's going to be, it seems it's being pushed for in certain policies to want to bring people in and closer and not spread them out in community. But we have the space, just not in California. We have the space, just not in New York, right? And that's part of the problem too, is so many people are bunched in these little spots. And like you said, farming becomes a big factor where we need to truck all this food in. You're not making any in the city because it's so overpopulated. There is no way you could grow a plant in New York City.
Right.
And you wouldn't be able to do it and call it a healthy plant to eat. There's not one chance. So you run into these issues if you keep popping in these major cities, is where are you even going to have a place to grow organic food safely?
Look, California had a problem. We had the psychiatric state hospitals. Mm-hmm. They built another one. They built it out in a rural area, but they had real problems with housing. They didn't have enough. It wasn't close enough to the labor force to staff the hospital.
Oh, goodness.
Because there was overcrowding in the state psychiatric hospitals, so they built another one. But you got to also think that
you got to staff it.
You got to staff it. These are not traditional, I think, Democrat or Republican issues. We just have to realize that we have this imbalance between the supply of housing, the supply of jobs, and the number of people. And I give this as an example. San Luis Obispo is dependent a lot on tourism. Like a lot of cities, we have municipal parking lots. They used to have very attendance at the municipal parking lot. These were hardworking, friendly people that you want for tourists. But now they've gone to an automated system, and there's only a few parking attendants left for occasions. And
that robot is probably getting paid better than us humans.
Right. They not only put in the robots and just laid off people, but they raise the parking rates too, which really bothers me. But now those people don't have jobs. What do you view if you know where do they go now for a decent paying job? But you know it's not
right that they may have worked years to raise their salary.
Yeah, and I can understand the city needed to save money. You had pension costs, you had health costs, you know, you had people costs. But there's a society cost there.
Right.
When someone can't have it, when you lay off people.
Right. I think that's one of the huge problems is making jobs that people can move into now that we're displacing so many workers via technology, AI. You can make so many different claims here.
Right, right. You know, manufacturing, automobiles are far more complex than they were like 20, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They're far more complex. But
the amount of hands that need to touch it, yep.
Yeah, but the amount of automation has increased more so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, manufacturing is about two-thirds of what was in the 1980s. Manufacturing stuff is a little bit more, a little less, depending on policies, but it doesn't really change a lot. It's because the market forces are more powerful than a government tax credit or a government, what a policy or not on non-policy. The market forces are saying, hey, we need to produce our product as cheaply as possible. That means a robot. So that's people who could have had a decent factory job.
Mm.
Where do they go now? And so this is one of the things I don't want my book. I try to avoid just being all complaining about society, price of housing is so high, and this is the. I wanted to offer some solutions here.
Right.
And one solution, I think, and it's not a panacea. Well, I've mentioned already about the child support. The child support for the absent father and welfare
absolutely
should go to the kids. Another, I think, to tie in with dads is two things. One is high school graduation rates should be posted by gender. Almost all school districts have websites now. They'll tell you all about their school and how many teachers and blah, blah, blah. But they should be required, because they almost all get federal money, to post your graduation rates broken down by gender. You got to identify a problem before you treat it. And I think just even highlighting that will help bring some solutions.
Sure.
My pet thing about that is that so many of the boys in my caseload, basically, most of the kids would say school is stupid, but they particularly thought school was stupid with respect to what books they had to read in English classes.
That is absolutely correct.
That fiction reading, 80% of all fiction books are sold to women.
Correct. Okay. But it's 90 to 95% of what we read in school.
Right. In your English classes, it's almost all fiction. And so
English class is all fiction. The only place you read nonfiction is history or science.
Right.
If you go into English class, it is fiction.
Right. Right. There might be an elective for journalism or an elective for debate, but you're right. You're right. 90% of it, 90%. And we need to have more nonfiction writing, because that's how you need to learn to write nonfiction in the workplace. You know, if you're supervisor, you want to write a sales report or.
I think it's important to incorporate too, though, because, like, for example, my fiance is studying nursing, and her writing ability is very subpar, because all she's really ever had to write about, I think, is fiction. You can make up a story in half a second, but when you're talking about writing where you need to document or you need to display research, it's not poorly, or it's not well put together. It's always very poorly brought together with a central theme. There almost is none.
Right, right. And so I think we need to have at least a year of nonfiction writing.
That would be fair.
Yeah. So, yeah. And so those are two things that I think are amongst the long list of things that we should do to make the, make it better, have greater graduation rates, to reduce poverty.
Absolutely. Does your book have a whole section on what you think could be viable solutions?
I kind of put it along the way. So in each chapter, sometimes I give a little history of something, but I don't put them all at the end, because I've read books like that and I find I don't read them anymore.
Halfway through.
So I put the ideas in the book along the way.
Got it. And was there a time frame that you were looking at this issue, or was it basically ever since we had statistics on this type of conflict with either income gaps or with gender inequality?
Well, it's just one of those things that I've been noticing along the way, and I've my bachelor's degree is in psychology and political science. So I've always had that political science interest of wanting to, what policies can government adopt that make sense? Everybody wants the potholes filled. You know, everybody is against crime. Everybody wants a good environment, you know, but what can we do on a practical level to, you know, address these issues of homelessness and address these issues? You know, if you look at someone who's homeless, I mean, the under the bridge down by the creek bed kind of homeless, almost always that's a man. And that man has family. That man may have children. What has led to that point for him to be there? And if you can prevent him from getting sleeping down by the creek, it's far cheaper. Intervening when somebody's that far down out of the economic mainstream is very expensive and very time consuming, very exhausting. And, you know, so we need to do more to prevent those situations.
Right. I can't help but think that, especially with the way that we've tried to solve problems ever since my lifetime started, or at least when I could start paying attention, with all of the money that's been funneled through government hands, I think it might be time for, especially as communities more so, but as a nation, to come together in communities, like religious communities, or even just communities based in our area, or based around, you know, maybe it's your school boards or however you want to treat this, but that's where you have your opportunity to help people out. That's where you have your opportunity to pull your funds together and donate together and make sure that those funds are going to the right spot. But you have more control in that type of community where you have a say than giving your tax dollars and hoping that the government is going to address the issue, but with policy. At this point, I think the issue's gone over the heads of all of us, including our government.
Yeah, I think some people just, you know, don't understand the nuances of government programs. I do think that some communities are better than others. And so some communities are going to organize. But, you know, we have a very good food program here in San Luis Obispo, even though it's a fairly affluent area. There's still many that are in need, but there's a very fairly successful food program.
Right.
But in the next county over, is there? I don't know.
Right, right.
But and you'd never like have to have control of that. Everybody. Yeah.
Hey, guys. I just wanted to take a second and thank you for joining the show today. And thank Lance for hopping on and sharing his view of everything that's going on, especially with his background and with his book. So without further ado, up on the screen right now is his book, as well as the link in the description that'll point you in the direction of finding his work. I think that it's super important to light these issues up and make them more of the center of the conversation. So without further ado, let's get right back into the show.
I did have a question. Did you see any positive effects of actually having women take over certain industries, like you mentioned earlier, rather than leading to negative effects like we talked about?
I don't know quite what you mean. I'm not
so when you mentioned earlier that women were taking over fields like psychology or medicine, veterinary, did you see positive effects from this? Or was it more just you trying to apply information that you saw to a problem, trying to diagnose it?
I was just wanting to illustrate the education gap that I think is not illustrated. As far as positive effects, I'm sure that it led, you know, there's a lot to be. I know Revlon has this thing now where they're trying to, if you see her, you can be her. They have a lot of public service announcements like that.
Sure.
So I think there's that thing.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, I'm just curious because it seems like you don't really fall on either side of the coin here, and you seem like you want to be putting out information for people to see it and make their own better judgment off of it. Have you ever been involved in politics after you left CPS, or was it really writing that took you into retirement?
I haven't been active in politics other than voting and a minor contribution to a candidate that I might like, and minor contributions to nonprofits that I thought. It's very brutal out there.
Oh yeah.
You know, and maybe I don't have enough skin for politics.
That wouldn't
CPS, I'd have a thick skin, but I'm not sure.
No, that wouldn't be my suggestion necessarily, but it was more so like, is that an interest of yours? And would it ever be a venture of you to try to weigh in on stuff where your book really does take it to the lines where it seems people are not willing to discuss anymore. Even just bringing up the facts is hard to do nowadays because people are going to question your sources and question everything that you use to arrive at the conclusion. So I was really just curious on how it looks in the onset of what's happened in California over the past, really my whole lifetime. It's just tended to one side of the political spectrum. And just leave it at that.
Yeah. I mean, California is known as a liberal state. There's part of that. And I don't want to have any of those liberal labels so much. I just wanted to, hey, throw these ideas out as part of a solution.
Exactly. Because, yep. And I think you mentioned it before. It's not an issue of Republican or Democrat.
Yeah. I say in the preface to my book, neither the conservatives or liberals have a monopoly on good or bad ideas. You know,
correct.
There's a lot of bad ideas on both sides of the political spectrum.
Absolutely.
That's what I want to do is put facts out there, offer some suggestions that I think that people could agree upon, not so much controversial things, because at least you do something. If you, we should all do this. Like the websites, school websites. Okay, that's not going to cost any money to speak of, and yet that may address a problem or may help address a problem. Like more nonfiction in schools. Again, not a cost issue, because I know a lot of people, we don't spend any more money. I don't want government spending more money. So I'm trying to offer ideas that are palatable to both sides.
Yeah, definitely. I think that that's at least a reasonable approach, because you can't make an argument with what you're saying. I think you're approaching it really well.
Thank you.
I wanted to take a step back from your book and just question you a little bit. Do you have any other interests outside of trying to shine light on things like this? Do you spend a lot of time with your family, assuming you might have grandkids at this point as well? What are some of your things that you do aside from podcasting, talking about what you've researched?
Well, I'm a place where I'm fortunately I can travel. I just went to the U.S. Virgin Islands.
That's awesome.
Wife.
How did you like that?
It's very interesting. They drive on the left-hand side there because the Virgin Islands used to be part of Denmark. So they drive on the left-hand side, yeah. But they're all American-built cars with a steering wheel.
You know,
so it's very interesting driving in the Virgin Islands. But lovely, lovely snorkeling. But, you know, you could just see when you're snorkeling how the wasting is because of global warming. The water temperatures are so warm. And, you know, obviously you have more people that's everybody's turning on their air conditioner. You're going to generate, you're going to, I worry about people in Phoenix and Texas that, you know, what are we going to do if the power grid fails? And you already have
right
people going to hospitals. And so we need to realize that population growth in the United States is an issue here that needs to be addressed. And how can we do this to reduce the number of people that are dependent upon government assistance of one form or another? I don't think we want to be cold-hearted to people. We want government there to help people who really need help.
Right.
But like you said, with the shovel, you know, the hole needs to get smaller somehow.
Yeah, definitely. So I think a big part of that is helping people get off of that government help. That seems to be lacking in a big way in today's government in America.
Well, I think part of it is practicalities too. For instance, subsidized housing, Section 8 housing. If that person doesn't have a job that can pay for market rate housing, then that person's stuck on government support, not because they necessarily want to be on the dole, but because there's not either they don't have the education for the job mm-hmm. that would be self-sufficient, or their job doesn't exist. And right. so that's one of the things that that's a struggle we have. Mm-hmm. You know, you're right. If once person gets, very few people get off public housing because in San Luis, in my experience, because in San Luis Obispo, housing costs so much. And, right. you know, my daughter and her boyfriend are living in Camarillo, which is just about 2 hours south of us. They pay $2,400 a month for a one bedroom apartment.
Right.
Yeah. And you how much do you have to earn to afford a $2,400 a month apartment? That's, you know, for correct. A lot of people, even if you were, you know, someone making $4,000 a month, that's most places, that's a pretty good salary, but maybe, you know.
No, for affording housing, it's tough.
It's tough. And then how do we do that? One of the things that I offer in the book, as far as ideas, is to tap the private sector. Say, okay, you build a 100-unit apartment complex, and for 20 of those units, no more than 20, because you don't want to be all public housing, we're going to not tax you for any income you have on that, for any profit you have on those houses. But if you rent, you won't have tax. So you're providing housing for poor, but you're not making so much that it's, you know, so that will encourage the building of that kind of housing, because, hey, I've got a tax break. I'm a builder. I can get more money. It encourages people, because if you don't have stable housing, people are more likely to make bad decisions in their life. They're more likely right. to say, oh, why is life worth living? Why don't I get high and just for an afternoon not have to think about my problems or get drunk? So the social ills that come from homelessness or unstable housing are there too. And so our society pays for that.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. I think there's a lot of incentive too, and I'm sure you've heard about this as well. When you have a issue like it is in California, especially with the homeless rate, when you have a problem that's that large, and you even have sectors of the government that are dedicated to taking care of the homeless problem, you have salaries that are paid out to these people. And some of these people might be incentivized to continue having their job or their work be growing, like we were talking about before with CEOs. When you're talking about just a human being and trying to grow themselves, they're going to grow their salary. They're not going to protect it. So wouldn't they be incentivized to keep this homeless problem there?
No. I got to tell you, working in child welfare, I always said we never had to want for business. So got I it. Don't see... There's so much out there that they...
And you think that was the main tenor of a lot of the people that you worked with as well?
Yeah, we never wanted for business. We never had to worry about kind of making sure we still had clients. No, the phone right. was always ringing. So, no.
That's sad. That's sad.
And no, it's very hard because I make sure, burnout.
But that's a... Right, but that's a huge, huge argument from, I would say, a lot of conservative thinkers, that you're incentivizing the homeless problem by having these people earn so much money. I think what you just said is a very good point.
Yeah. For child welfare, it has one of the highest burnout rates than, you know, in civil service.
I'm sure, just because of the issues that you're facing every day.
Yeah. So, no, I don't think so. In fact, the local housing homeless program has wanted for staff. There was a big article in our local paper. They have like so many positions open. Because it's very discouraging if you're working with that kind of... I thought, oh, maybe I might have to do that. They had a part-time... No, I don't want to, even though I've done that. It's a very hard work, and
to put yourself back into that would be quite an ask.
The reward frustration level sometimes gets out of kilter. You know, everybody gets frustrations with work. Everybody gets frustrated, but if you got enough rewards, you're going to stay in the job. I think the burnout is here because the rewards aren't there in the emotional rewards. Financially, I don't think they're going to be paid. Certainly, San Luis Obispo, nothing that's going to be a huge cost. The cost is going to be in more other respects, like, you know, trying to help housing, you know,
Correct. You think that because this seems to be an issue in every sort of industry, but if you were to pay those workers higher, would the burnout rate start to decrease slowly?
You cut out again.
Would if you were to increase that pay rate, you think you would slowly see the burnout rate decrease, or is it such a stressful field that the burnout rate is going to be high no matter what?
I think there's a good example from foster parents. For many, many years, the foster parent rate, the reimbursement rate for foster parents was not increased. And so fewer and fewer people, I think that increased when they decided, hey, if we pay foster parents a little bit more, we'll not only divert kids from going to expensive group homes, well, our retention rate will increase. It didn't stop. The slide slowed down a lot because it was pretty substantial. I don't know the figures offhand, but it did. And I know a lot of people, they just don't care for foster children for the money. No, it's still a negative cost. But if you're in cold business terms, if your foster child is costing $100, that's a lot different than $600. You know, that's the kind of thing that, it's still a negative loss, but it's not as bad when you have a decent foster parent reimbursement rate. So that did help retention with foster parents.
Right. But I think that's a great example to bring up. But that points out to every single area of business. And if you're a business owner, just hear that if you are having trouble with retention, there's a very good chance that you're actually struggling with a payment problem and not any other problem other than that. Look at nurses, look at doctors, right? The horrific things that they see on a daily basis, but they're not burning out at a rate that public service workers are burning out at, especially ones that are dealing with child issues, like one like yourself.
Yeah.
All right, man. Lance, I don't have too much more to ask because I've been a little bit taken aback by some of the things I've learned today. I'm sure my audience is feeling a little bit the same. Did you have anything else you wanted to bring up or let us know? Something maybe even that kind of shocked you in your research that maybe didn't make it into the book. Anything else that you had, Lance?
If I could just share one more thing about home ownership.
Yes, please.
Let's imagine America is just 100 households. And 50 of those households are homeowners. And 50 of those households are renters. Mm-hmm. And everybody has $10,000 in savings. But the homeowners have $10,000 in equity. And over 10 years, that equity goes up $10,000 a year. How much? So the wealth in the originally starts off as 2/3 of America was owned by the homeowners and 1/3 by the renters. But after 10 years, it's more like about 80%.
Right.
So that's how important homeownership is. And how we need to encourage and have policies that people can pass that equity onto their children, and we can prevent poverty. If you give a person a welfare check, that may keep them out of poverty for that moment. But if you don't have them way by which they could acquire housing, in some ways that they could have sweat equity like the Habitat for Humanity programs. Then you haven't prevented it for the next generation. And that's one of the things that I've tried is to look at long-term solutions. So that's just my last little thing I want to put in there.
No, I appreciate that because it actually got me stirring on a thought that I will end it on home ownership in this, or a recommendation that I would have is that policy-wise, as a country, I think we need to just put our foot down in this and saying, no matter where it's coming from, outside investment, so outside of our country, should stop at home buying. That should not be allowed. Yes, you could buy a business. Yes, you could put up your corporation to try to earn money or send back to your country. Yes. But to be talking about foreign interest in our housing market, and especially buying rental property, maybe a vacation home you can make an argument for, but if you're earning rent as a foreign citizen, I think we need to put an end to that. You see these massive investment firms coming up and investing outside dollar into our land because they see how profitable it is over time. They're not going to stop that. And they don't care if they'll take a loss on the five-year project because they're looking at this on an outlook of 30 years. They may be even a country's investments. That's my recommendation there, because I think that's one way to at least start to roll back on these huge price increases over time?
That's like I said, I think there's not one grand solution, but there's a lot of solutions. Definitely like not. Saying, okay, you know, no foreign corporations buying American land.
Yep.
Yeah.
So. Yep. I think that we could both agree that most of these solutions we've come up with today are just common sense and nothing more and right. Nothing less.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
But I believe that that is one of the things that our government and just our country as a whole is seeming to lack a little bit more and more each day, unfortunately. And I think that's on us, the author, the podcast, the all of us in media and trying to put out good content and just seeking common sense and the truth.
That's true. That's very good. Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
No, thanks for coming.
It's been a very fast hour. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, we blazed through it. I don't want to belabor your points because I know I talk a little fast. I think I made you spit a little bit quicker than normal today. But you did very well. I think that this was, like I said, eye-opening for me. I think that a lot of people are going to engage with this. And yeah, everybody else, I will catch you guys very soon. Lance, be well. I hope to have you on again soon. Maybe you have book number 3 coming out.
Okay, great. All right, thanks a lot.
Absolutely. Take have care. A good one. Say, damn, I wish I were the fucking state. I want to be something, not nothing. Trapped inside my dream and I'm running. Running away from these demons. But the feeling's so good, I'm a